Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Mark Doty. Mark Doty has published 5 volumes of nonfiction and 8 collections of poetry, including Fire to Fire, New and Selected Poems, which won the National Book Award for Poetry in 2008. His new book, Deep Lane, was published in the spring of 2015. Doty says Deep Lane is about descending, sinking more deeply into one's life. The poems often make use of subterranean images, earth and transformation and hidden life below. Doty's poems have appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, the London Review of Books, and the New Yorker, among other publications, and he has been given a wide range of honors, including the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, a Whiting Writers Award, and 2 Lambda Literary Awards. He is the only American poet to have received the T.S. Eliot Prize in the U.K. Here's Mark Doty in 2015 as part of Poetry Downtown at the Winningstead Theater.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here. I know Andrew from his work at Penn, the wonderful activist and advocacy organization for writers, and a bit from his New York publishing time. I thank him for this opportunity. And Susan, who, you can say to Susan, I need to change my plane reservation, like 3 days before you're here. And she says, okay, and goes and does it. Unflappable. Incredibly organized. So it's a real delight. And it's wonderful to read with Trevino. And in this space, which is extraordinarily beautiful, and sort of Elizabethan industrial style, kind of. It's great. Now, Walt Whitman said in Song of Myself, "This hour I tell things in confidence. I may not tell everybody, but I will tell you." Very interesting thing to say in a poem addressed to the world, right? That sense of intimacy. Well, in that spirit, I'm going to open with a moment of vulnerability. I am in the process of having a dental implant. That means that I have a temporary crown on one of my front teeth. It doesn't stay in very well, and although I'm working on it. And when I speak in public, it has a tendency sometimes to just pop out. So I will, if at some point I you know, this gesture is becoming more subtle, if I sort of reach my hand up and something disappears, you won't worry, okay? You have a clue as to what has taken place. And I will stop smiling. That's also how you'll know that this has happened. So I have this new book, Deep Lane, which has been out now for all of 2 weeks. It's a thrilling experience and a strange one because something that has been potentially infinite in my imagination with gaps, with new doors, places to go, things I don't know yet, suddenly becomes fixed. Here it is. There will never be more poems in here. I could fudge with them a little bit, but basically this is it. They're not going to get revised. So that something immense, the palace of the imagination becomes the little house of the book. It's an odd feeling. I like it, but startling. After many years, it's still startling. This book is called Deep Lane because although I live in New York City, I, for 7 years now, have been spending a lot of time in a little cottage out on the far east end of Long Island on the South Fork. And about a mile from my house is a road called Deep Lane. And it's a really nice little country road. But what I really like is the name, the 2 monosyllables, the long vowels, Deep Lane, the sense of sort of going forward and down. It's a phrase that calls my attention. And as I've lived with it, it became a kind of mantra and a kind of magnet, sort of pulling meanings to itself. And in a while, I found myself writing a poem called Deep Lane. And when I was finished, I knew I hadn't said anything about Deep Lane in the poem. And I also knew there was much more to say. And so I began a series of poems in which that name serves as a kind of central metaphor. And I wrote a bunch of them. In the book, there are 9 of them. And I'm going to start with some of those. This one, the character you will meet besides the speaker is my dog, Ned, who is a golden retriever and a fine exemplar of the breed. I just read my ex's memoir, and and in it he says, "Golden retriever." Oh, I was furious. What does he want with a golden retriever? Oh. May this never happen to you. Okay. D-plane. June 23rd, evening of the first fireflies. We're walking in the cemetery down the road, and I look up from my distracted study of whatever, an unfocused gaze somewhere a few feet in front of my shoes, and see that Ned has run on ahead, with the champagne plume of his tail held especially high, his head erect, which is often a sign that he has something he believes he is not allowed to have. And in the gathering twilight, what is it that is gathered? Who is doing the harvesting? I can make out that the long horizontal between his lovely jaws is one of the four stakes planted on the slope to indicate where a backhoe will dig the new grave. Of course, my impulse is to run after him, to replace the marker, out of respect for the rule that we won't desecrate the tombs, or at least for those who knew the woman whose name inks a placard in the rectangle claimed by the four poles of vanishing, three poles now, and how it's within their recollection, their gathering, she'll live. Evening of memory, spark lamps in the grass. I stand and watch him go in his wild figure eights. I say, you run, darling. You tear up that hill. As I realize later, like, as if he needs permission from me to do that, right? But this poem, this deep lane poem, has to do with the work of the gardener. Those of you who are gardeners know that if you purchase a new house or you inherit a garden, it may be lovely, but it's never right. Right? Everything must be moved. Things must be changed. And I was in the process of doing that and began to wonder, you know, who is this for? All that work. The poem also remembers the late Deborah Diggs, a marvelous poet who left us now about 4 years ago. Deep lane. When I'm down on my knees, pulling up wild mustard by the roots before it sets seed, hauling the old ferns further into the shade, I'm talking to the anvil of darkness. Break table. Slab no blow could dent, rung with the making, and out of that chop and rot comes the fresh surf of the lupins. When the shovel slips into white root flesh, into the meat coursing with cool water, when I'm grubbing on my knees, what is the hammer? Dusky skin of the tuber, naked worms who write on the soil every letter, my companion blind. All day we go digging, harrowing, rooting deep. Spade plunge and trowel, sweet turned down gas flame, slow charring carbon, out of which sprouts the wild unsayable. Beauty's the least of it. You get ready, like Deborah, who used to garden in the dark, hauling out candles and a tall glass of what she said was tea, and digging and reading and studying in the dirt. She'd bring a dictionary. If study is prayer, she said, I'm praying. If you've already gone down to the anvil, if you've rested your face on that adamant, maybe you're already changed. More gardening lore. Okay, if you order anything from a garden catalog, you promptly receive 150 more garden catalogs. And I got one, which was from a company that sells bearded iris, which are the most outrageously hybridized, wildly colored, and wildly named things. And they had a plant called Anvil of Darkness. And I thought, can you imagine choosing to grow the Anvil of Darkness? And I thought I'd write this little comic poem about that, but you see what happened. Deep lane. We began to think the whitefish individual, the one of the pair who'd struggled, after all, when our pond's colder water shocked and he lay pulsing in the shallows till we thought him all but gone, then simply drew himself up, if this were something a fish could do, and swam away. I shouldn't have told you. A heron ate his mate. He surfaced in March after his first season entombed in the bottom mud, unscathed, a 4-inch emperor in his white silk coat, insignia of the kingdom splashed over his back, the color of candied orange rind. He'd nose up out of the lily murk when our shadows crossed his borders, pushed to the edge to open the translucent white ring of his mouth over and over as if begging, as if, seems to want, seems to feel. But as we knew him, semblance fell away. We felt the presence of the soul of him, if soul could be understood as specificity, so that when he himself was swallowed, white appetite perched on the roof, bill raised to the air, the throat unrelenting, the absence in the pond grew resonant, a sort of empty ringing. Where were the details then? The gestures that had marked him? Heap stones and elder, mullein and pokeweed. How can I take any pleasure in this garden? Heap stones and elder, mullein and pokeweed is also from Mr. Whitman. It's a moment when he has this sort of experience of sexual transcendence, and all the world seems to him so filled with blessing, even the heap stones and elders, mullein and pokeweed. And you can see in this poem, the heap stones and elders are filled with something else. You will remember perhaps a Manichaeanism, which is the heresy that suggests the world is equally divided into forces of good and evil, darkness and light, and that the outcome of the struggle is not yet known. Deep lane. Into Eden came the ticks, princes of this world, heat-seeking, tiny, multitudinous. Lord, why have you given them a heart, a nervous system, a lit microchip of a brain, is it, if not to invite Manichaeanism? Hard to believe, the force that shaped the mild tortoise traversing the undergrowth with smallest steps, the sway-necked lily, hard to countenance that same mind dotting paradise with pinhead demons wanting nothing but to gorge, to suck beyond the dreams of their hell brothers, the mosquitoes. Implacable, without boundary, pure appetite. I wouldn't know anything about that. So it's wonderful. I love the West Coast. I was very happy to come here. The landscape just really sings to me. And I was lucky enough to spend a guest semester teaching at Stanford and had time, you know, to wander around some places. And I want to read you, therefore, because I'm here, these few little West Coast poems. And the first one has to do with the poet Robinson Jeffers, who, you know, if anybody ever loved animals more than people, it was Robinson Jeffers. He was really troubled by human presence and sort of looked forward, not that he would be there, but looked forward imaginatively to the time when people were gone and the elemental forces of the earth held sway. Robinson Jeffers. Why think sun and stones less alive than sea lions? Why privilege proteins or the slow burn of carbohydrates? Is that the only life there is? Or, he might say, fire and granite suffer as much as everything else. It would be a diminishment not to think so. Still, he'd walk the shore evenings with his bulldog, bowlegs working to keep pace, darting to the foam line, distracted by pleasure, racing to catch up again, delay then hurry, the creature performing a cheerful little drama. And the poet, who could not be wholeheartedly pleased with anything human, he liked that too. This one comes from standing on the pier at Santa Cruz and seeing these extraordinary creatures. Perfect repose. Turning so effortlessly, you wouldn't call it that, what they do. Sliding easily over, a kind of oscillation, on their sides, most of them, floating together in their troop. Perhaps 25 of them, just off the pier, though you couldn't count them, the sea lions. They curve around one another. Two break away, one joins, the group drifts with the tide. Whose flipper or tail raised to the sun? Whose head lifted out of the green? They lie a little beneath the surface, now and then turning the face up to breathe, which is suddenly how you know they're asleep. Simultaneous, intimate, soft, plosive, a little wet, and though one coughs now and then, water in the nose, the single thing they make of many, still and always moving, as if air were also a wave, now arrived at the drifting shore of what pronoun? I mean thou. All breathe in again at once. I am pleased to tell you this next poem has been selected for an anthology that the United Nations has just put out. And it's a book in celebration of World Happiness Day. Did you know there was a World Happiness Day? Stand back, National Poetry Month, right? So you know, what poem, I think it's the only poem I've ever written that could go in an anthology for World Happiness Day. You know, it's just not, you know, when you're happy, what do you want to do? You want to write a poem? No. You want to kiss somebody? You want to go for a walk? You want to, I don't know, whatever. But pain requires analysis and attention. Okay. A happy poem. Pescadero. The little Pescadero is a little town south of San Francisco, if you don't know. Pescadero. The little goats like my mouth and fingers. And one stands up against the wire fence and taps on the fence board a hoof made blacker by the dirt of the field. Pushes her mouth forward to my mouth so that I can see the smallish squared seeds of her teeth and the bristle whiskers. And then she kisses me, though I know it doesn't mean kiss. Then leans her head way back, arcing her spine, goat yoga, all pleasure and greeting, and then good-natured indifference. She loves me. She likes me a lot. She takes interest in me. She doesn't know me at all, or need to, having thus acknowledged me, though I am all happiness, since I have been welcomed by the field's small envoy, and the splayed hoof, fragrant with soil, has rested on the fence board beside my hand. So that came out in a national magazine, and it produced really the best mail I've ever had. A goat farmer, actually, I believe in Oregon, wanted to know me better. The citizens of Pescadero expressed pleasure in being so represented. And most delightfully, a teacher at an alternative school in the Bay Area wrote to say that every year the kindergarten class went to the goat farm at Pescadero. And the first graders who didn't get to go stayed back at school and read my poem, and they reminisced about their trip. Mm-hmm. What better fate for a poem can you think of? Mm-hmm. And so one more animal poem. Animals have been, throughout my life, a real presence in my work as guides, as metaphors, as apparitions, things to hold human feeling, and also something resistant about them. You know, we can only know them to a point, right? You look into the eyes of, you know, a parrot, and it's clear that there's intelligence there and awareness, but it's not like yours, you know? And so we have to think about, what is that mind, and then what is my mind if I'm not like that? A few years ago, on the cover of the National Geographic magazine was a beautiful photograph of the best preserved specimen of a mammoth ever found, a woolly mammoth. It was a baby mammoth. I think it was a month old, 2 months old, something like that. No, 1 month. And it had been remarkably preserved by the fact that it had drowned in a mud bank. Climate change, you know, thawed the bank out, and there it was. I tried to describe this thing. I tried and tried. My poem was totally lifeless. And suddenly I realized, well, the mammoth needs to speak. Little mammoth. Mother's milk in my belly, and a little of her shit, too, so that I might eat of the sour green steps that opened endlessly before me. Though not long after I slid into sunlight and the grass world, I slid again into the mud hole and screamed, and screaming sucked clay into my trunk till I lay on the bottom, my milk tusks not even sprouted, a sweet undercoat of fat ready for my first winter. And I am still 1 month old and 40,000 years without my mother. Yeah. You know, of course, the odd line that poetry makes nothing happen. Not true. Poetry makes you go, oh. Yeah. Oh, okay. Now, I'm going to read you a new poem, which is not in the book. And it's one that was occasioned, it was rare for me, it's a poem that really has to do with a public event, something in the social space that I did not experience. And most of my poems grow directly out of, you know, having been up close to something, having been able to get the kind of perceptual information I need to fire my own imagination. But I was so outraged that any reservations I had about this event were, about writing about this, were overruled. This is a poem concerned with the death of Tamir Rice. Tamir Rice was the 12-year-old boy who was killed in November by the Cleveland police. He was playing in the park with a plastic gun. In 2 seconds, Tamir Rice, 2002, 2014. In 2 seconds, the boy's face climbed back down the 12-year tunnel of its becoming. A charcoal sunflower swallowing itself. Who has eyes to see or ears to hear? If you could see what happens fastest, unmaking the human irreplaceable, a star falling into complete gravitational darkness from all points of itself, all this, the held, loved body into which entered milk and music, honeying the cells of him, who sang to him, stroked the nape of the scalp, kissed the flesh knot after the cord completed its work of fueling into him the long history of those whose suffering was made more bearable by the as yet unknown of him, playing alone in some unthinkable future city, a Cleveland, whatever that might be. 2 seconds. To elapse the arc of joy in the conception bed, the labor of hands repeated until the hands no longer required attention, so that as the woman folded, her hopes for him sank into the fabric of his shirts and underpants. Down they go, swirling down into the maw of a greater dark. Treasure box, comic books, pocket knife, bell from a lost cat's collar. Why even begin to enumerate them when behind every tributary poured into him comes rushing backward all he hasn't been yet? Everything that boy could have thought or made, sung or theorized, built on the quavering but continuous structure that had preceded him, sank into an absence in the shape of a boy playing with a plastic gun in a city park in Ohio in the middle of the afternoon. When I say 2 seconds, I don't mean the time it took him to die. I mean the lapse between the instant the cruiser lurched to a halt on the grass, between that moment and the one in which the officer fired his weapon. The 2 seconds taken to assess the situation. I believe it is part of the work of poetry to try on, at least, the moment and skin of another. But for this hour, I respectfully decline. I refuse it. May that officer be visited every night of his life by an enormity collapsing in front of him into an incomprehensible bloom and the voice that howls out of it. If this is no poem, then... But that voice, erased boy, beloved of time, who did nothing to no one and became nothing because of it, I know that voice is one of the things we call poetry. It isn't to his killer he's speaking. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So let's see what time it is here. When I am not out near Deep Lane, I live in Manhattan, and you can't do that without it becoming your subject in some way, in that the city is a great repository and emblem of human life and all its joy and dejection, its ambition and its complexity. So I'm going to read you a couple of Manhattan poems. First, it's a little one about going to the gym. And it's called Ars Poetica, 14th Street Gym. And Ars Poetica, you probably know, is a poem where the poet says, this is what I think poetry is. And when I use the word sleeve in this poem, I'm referring to the full sleeve, you know, the tattoo. I have to tell people in Portland what that is. You know, no, I don't really know. Ars Poetica, 14th Street Gym. Beauty that does not disguise the wound, but reads through it to the lack it marks. The one-armed man lifts himself again on the assisted pull-up machine, sleeve of sparrows and morning glories swelling with each upward pull. In the locker room, I praise his ink, and he turns to thank me, and so I'll notice what you can't restore, inscribe, the blue wing needled on the socket.
You're listening to a performance by Mark Doty. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Doty is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. It's Mark Doty this time. Here he is again speaking in Portland in 2015.
This poem begins as a kind of meditation on habit and what happens when our habits are broken. you know, habit gets a very bad rep. Habit is said to shrink the gates of perception, to dull you to the new. But there are real advantages in habits, right? It means you don't have to, if you know what kind of muffin you have in the morning, you don't have to go through this whole decision-making process, which distracts you from your inner life, right? Flaubert said, you know, a writer should live a very uneventful life so that you could just pay attention. You know, good luck with that. So I think maybe particularly in cities, habits become ways of protecting ourselves from being overwhelmed. This is called, for reasons you will soon see, this your home now. For years, I went to the Peruvian barbers on 18th Street. Comforting. Welcome. The full coat rack, three chairs held by three barbers, eldest by the window, the middle one, a slight fellow who spoke an oddly feminine Spanish, the youngest last, red-haired, self-consciously masculine. And in each of the mirrors, their children's photos, mildly smutty cartoons, postcards from Machu Picchu. I was happy in any chair, though I liked best the touch of the oldest, who'd rest his hand against my neck in a thoughtless, confident way. 10 years, maybe. One day, the powdery blue steel shutters pulled down over the window and door, not to be raised again. They'd lost their lease. I didn't know how at a loss I'd feel. This haze around what I like to think the sculptural presence of my skull requires neither art nor science, but two haircuts on 7th, one in Dublin, nothing right. Then, I hear my friend Marie laughing over my shoulder, saying, in your poems, there's always a then. And I think, is it a poem without a then? Dull early winter, back on 18th, up spiraling red in a cylinder of glass, and just below the line of sidewalk, a new sign, Willie's Barbershop. Dark hallway, glass door, and there's presumably Willie. When I tell him I used to go down the street, he says in an inscrutable accent, this your home now. Puts me in a chair, asks me what I want, and soon he's clipping and singing with the radio's Latin dance tune. That's when I notice Willie's walls, though he's been here all the week, spangled with images hung in barbershops since the beginning of time. Lounge singers, near celebrities, random boxers, Italian boys, Puerto Rican, caught in the hour of their beauty, though they'd scowl at the word. Victors cheering over a trophy won for what? Frames already dusty at slight angles. Here it's clear forever. Are barbershops like aspens, each sprung from a common root 10,000 years old? Sons of one father, flashing fighters and starlets to shield the tenderness of their hearts? Our guardian Willie defies time, his chair our ferry boat, and we go down in the trance of touch and the skull buzz drone, singing cranial nerves in the direction of peace. And so I understand that in the back of this nothing building on 18th Street, I found that door ajar before in daylight when it shouldn't be. Some forgotten bulb left burning in a fathomless shaft of my uncharted nights. The men I have outlived await their turns, the fevered and wasted, whose mothers and lovers scattered their ashes and gave away their clothes. 20 years. And their names tumble into a numb well, though in truth I have not forgotten one of you, may I never forget one of you, these layers of men arrayed in their no longer breathing ranks. Willie, I have not lived well in my grief for them. I have lugged this weight from place to place as though it were mine to account for, and today I sit in your good chair in the sixth decade of my life, and if your back door is the threshold of the kingdom of the lost, yours is a steady hand on my shoulder. Go down into the still waters of this chair and come up refreshed, ready to face the avenue. Maybe I do believe we will not be left comfortless. After everything comes tumbling down, or you tear it down and stumble in the shadow valley trenches of the moon, there's still a decent chance at a barbershop, salsa on the radio, the instruments of renewal wielded effortlessly, and who'd have thought, for you. Willie, if he is Willie, thus is much longer over my head than my head merits, which allows me to be grateful without qualification. Could I be a little satisfied? There's a man who loves me, our dogs, 15, 20 more good years if I'm a bit careful. Is what I haven't written yet. It's sunny out, though cold. After I tip Willie, I'm going down to Jane Street to a coffee shop I like, and then I'm going to write this poem. Then... thanks very much. Well, I was going to read you the last poem, but I think it's too soon to read you the last poem. So I think I'm going to just add in, we're going to have two more poems, okay? And I think, since I started out talking about Walt Whitman, I'm going to go back there for a moment. I'm totally obsessed with Whitman. I'm, in fact, writing a prose book about him, as we speak. And it's taking me absolutely forever because I want to do justice to his extraordinary courage and inventiveness and also kind of argue with him about the strange ways in which he wanted to be a prophet, a sexual radical, a revolutionary, and he really wanted to be loved, too, by the public. That's a real hard one to pull off. And it wound up distorting him, that desire for approval. But I never want to complain about him too much because he seems to me the bravest poet of his time. And he also invented free verse as we know it and had remarkable courage and grace, really. So I was on the way to teach a class, and I was going to bring my students section 6 of Song of Myself, which begins, "A child said, 'What is the grass?' fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he." So I run in a used bookstore. I grab a copy off the shelf because in every used bookstore probably in the world is a copy of Leaves of Grass. And I don't look inside. I take it to class. I open it. What is the grass? On the margin, in the used text I purchased without opening, pale green dutiful vessel, some unconvinced student has written in a clear, looping hand, "Isn't it grass?" How could I answer the child? I do not exaggerate. I think of her question for years. And while first I imagine her the very type of the incurious, revealing the difference between a mind at rest and one that cannot, later, I come to imagine that she had faith in language. That was the difference. She believed that the word settled things. The matter need not be looked into again. And he who'd written his book over and over, nearly ruining it, so enchanted by what had first compelled him, for him, the word settled nothing at all. Which is why Leaves of Grass is that thick. Okay, this last poem. Do I need to say anything about this? Well, it just would be useful if you visualize hydrangeas. You know, those wonderful summer flowers that, as they fade, the colors get better, more complicated, richer, stranger. Spent. Late August morning, I go out to cut spent and faded hydrangeas, washed greens, russets, troubled little auras of sky, as if these were the very silks of Versailles, modeled by rain and ruin, then half restored after all this time. When I come back with my handful, I realize I've accidentally locked the door and can't get back into the house. The dining room window's easiest. Crawl through Beauty Bush and Spirea, push aside some errant maples, take down the wood frame screen, hoist myself up, but how exactly to clamber across the sill and the radiator down to the tile? I try bending one leg in, but I don't fold readily. I push myself up so that my waist rests against the sill and lean forward, place my hands on the floor, and begin to slide down into the room, which makes me think this was what it was like to be born. Awkward. Too big for the passageway. Negotiate. Submit. When I give myself to gravity, there I am, inside, no harm. The dazzling, splotchy flower heads scattered around me on the floor. Will leaving the world be the same? Uncertainty as to how to proceed, some discomfort, and suddenly you're where? I am so involved with this idea, I forget to unlock the door. So when I go out to fetch the mail, I'm locked out again. Am I at home in this house? Would I prefer to be out here, where I could be almost anyone? This time it's simpler. The window frame, the radiator, my descent. Born twice in one day. In their silver jug, these bruise-blessed flowers, how hard I had to work to bring them into this room. When I say spent, I don't mean they have no further coin. If there are lives to come, I think they might be a little easier than this one. Thank you very much. Thank you. Love it. Thank you. Thank you.
Don't go anywhere. Oh, you've got questions.
Go out and come in again.
Write your questions on cards, on the cards there, and then we'll one of the ushers will pick them up for me. If the ushers could put their hands up so we can see, there they are. Cool. We've got some that come in via social media and stuff before the event, so we'll start with those, and then as those come forward, we'll make sure to get to those right away.
Like CNN.
What's that?
It's like CNN.
Yeah, that's right. We do our best. Do you think your work is particularly American?
Oh, yeah, I guess. My influences come from lots of places, and some of the poets I love best are non-Americans. Cavafy, Rilke, Garcia Lorca, enormously important to me. But, you know, it's finally Whitman and Dickinson who lie behind the work of pretty much all of us contemporary American poets. The kind of combination of looking towards experience to teach us, to instruct us, and trying to look very deeply into things, and these conflicting impulses toward expansion and contraction feel to me very American. I never felt like an American poet until I got lucky enough to get a publisher in Britain, so I would go over there to do readings and to talk, and suddenly I felt very American indeed. One British reviewer criticized my work for giving the audience a great big American bear hug. The idea being you should really be a little more buttoned up with your emotions, you know? On the other hand, I've also had a wildly, you know, nice reception there. And it's interesting, the two American poets that seem to be most read at the moment by people in the UK are Sharon Olds and myself. What's that about? Passion.
How does your poetry writing inform your nonfiction writing or vice versa?
I started out as a poet. I started writing poetry in high school. And I was always interested in prose, but I never felt like I knew what I was doing. And things changed when my partner of a dozen years died in 1994. And I felt poetry was unavailable to me. You know, grief had just simply broken my life, but also had broken my form. And I was desperate. I couldn't write anything. I had trouble reading and concentrating. And a friend asked me if I would contribute an essay to an anthology called Wrestling with the Angel, when gay men write about faith and religion. And I said, yeah, I will. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't start. Well, I was washing the dishes one night. Suddenly this line comes into my head, like, oh, that's the first sentence. And I started to think of another. And I thought, well, I go to the computer. Down goes the first sentence. There's another one behind it, another one behind that. And the sentences became like, you know, the rope that you could hold on to go through the cave and go through some very dark place. It was such a relief. Writing prose became a way to focus. And poetry is always such a, even a long poem, it's a highly compressed container, right? Only the essential things can be there. Prose, at least, has the surface of expansiveness. You know, you can hold so much. And so I loved writing nonfiction as a way to just put more in and put more in. Luckily, I had an editor who would take it out and take it out. So I wound up writing a book which observed a year of grief. It's called Heaven's Coast. And when I had, sometime towards the end of that process, I was writing poems again. But I had this lovely feeling of being ambidextrous, you know, that there was something I could do with the welling up of intense emotion, and there was something I could do when I wanted a larger context and to stand back. So now I feel like I need both of those things.
What is the oddest moment that has inspired one of your poems?
Oh. Wow.
I think it says moment or object, but I can't quite get the handwriting.
When I'm thinking about the word wildest. You know, what is wild to us? One wild moment would be in Barcelona, climbing up the Sagrada Familia, the great Gaudi Cathedral there, right? And it's in America, when we are in high places or we're exposed to a risk, we have a big fence in front of us, right? If you're on some lookout of the Grand Canyon, you have a railing. The Spanish don't really think that way, you know? So to climb the Sagrada Familia, you have this little winding staircase up one spire, and there are people behind you, so you can't turn around, and it's narrow, up and up. And suddenly, there's the other spire over there, and to get to it, there's this footbridge that arcs, and you're above the Mediterranean, the entire city, and the hilltop that you're on top of a cathedral. And I don't like high places. And I did it. It took me a very long time. And then you have to go down another little winding staircase very fast because people behind you want to move. So that became a poem about the sublime, you know, that when we encounter enormous beauty, it's scary, it's threatening, overwhelming, and glorious at the same time. So I guess that would be one. They're all kind of weird, really. I mean, they all sort of begin in moments of, honestly, a kind of a feeling. It's almost like an irritation. That there's something in this experience I want to understand, I want to get at, and I don't know what it is. And occasionally a poem just tanks because I never know what it is. But if I'm lucky, in the process of description, I start to get clues as to why this thing matters to me to write about.
This is obviously from a younger poet. What do you see happening in New York in terms of emerging poetry now and younger poets? Oh. What's happening?
Oh, well, what I like now is that I think this is true of the American literary scene in general, particularly among younger people. We used to be very balkanized. You know, when I was in poetry school way back, you know, in Arizona, we all read the same 6 or 7 white guys, basically. And they're very good white guys, but, you know, that's what we read and that's what we knew. In Berkeley, people were reading something else entirely different. In New York, something else. And we just didn't know. The advent of the net and of a larger creative writing culture has meant that we're much more in touch with possibilities. So I would see my graduate students bring in 1 week a poem in which there was no identifiable speaker, and it was a kind of language collage that was intended to provoke an experience based in language. And the next week, a sonnet. And the week after that, a personal narrative about an experience. And it's fantastic. This is what young poets need to do, is to borrow from everything to become yourself. So I think there's a lot of that in New York now. I was a guest at a slam evening where it was a formalist slam. And so, you know, people were slam. You had sonnets, villanelles, sestinas, which was great because there are only so many lines in them. And nobody's going to yell a sonnet at you, right? You have to do it a little more subtly. It was a wonderful evening. And so this crossover, you know, that those things can exist together. I see a lot of that now, and I think that's a really rich cultural possibility. Hmm.
Your poetry feels very intimate and personal. What is it like to share these parts of your life with a wide audience?
It's really fun.
Strangers.
When I was about 16, you could send a dollar to a commune in New Mexico, and you would get back this book by Ram Dass. And it was a handmade thing. It was, you know, had printed with rubber stamps and colored. And it was called Be Here Now. And it was amazing. It was about, you know, basically a sort of Buddhist perspective on experience. And on the cover was a mandala. It had a ring of fire, and in the center was an empty chair. And it was, you know, a simple cane chair. And that image I've never forgotten, because I think that's where my reader sits. When I'm speaking in a poem, there's this empty chair in front of me, and I'm talking to somebody who really wants to listen, you know, really is interested in understanding what I have to say, but needs, you know, I have to explain it. I can't just say it in a blunt way. I have to do it with nuance and care. That is a kind of intimacy with the doors and windows open, so that anybody can sort of look in or move into that chair and be in that relation. It's really important to me to have that kind of one-to-one or intimate relationship with the reader. This means that sometimes I'm saying things in poems that I wouldn't tell you over dinner, you know. This hour I tell things in confidence. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you. This is because of this feeling of safety that comes about through the intimacy of the poem. I truly believe that readers don't go to poetry as a source of scandalous gossip about the poet. We go to learn about ourselves, right? You read in order to find your own life reflected and your own emotions. I never felt that, or I never experienced that, or I know just what that's like. And so when we're reading poetry, we're collecting understandings and insights into experience. And that gives me a little bit of a feeling of a safety margin, too. Finally, I know from my own poems, I know from my students, if you take a risk, the reader feels that energy. If you avoid the difficult, your poem is likely to feel less engaging and less energetic than it should.
This is from Andrea Hollander.
Ah, hi, Andrea.
Your dog once wrote and published a memorable sonnet.
Yes.
Did he learn the form from you? Or is golden retrievals one of a kind?
This, I had gotten an assignment to for a book called Unleashed. It was an anthology of poems spoken by the writer's dog. And I thought, no. On the one hand, it's too cute. On the other, it's too difficult. You know, the voice of a dog, what is that like? And then my golden retriever at the time, Bo, we're out walking in the woods outside of Provincetown, and he starts dictating this sonnet to me. And it, you know, it's beaming at me. And he didn't act like a formalist, you wouldn't have thought, you know. But out comes, it was not Dana Joya, but out comes the poem. And it's actually not a conventional sonnet in that it totally mixes up its rhyme scheme. It does funny stuff. But it's him. And it allows for... It's actually a very serious poem. It's about a response to grief. Bo says, you know, you're always in some haze thinking about what you never can bring back. You know, you're always thinking about tomorrow. Is that what you call it? And so the dog then becomes a kind of Zen master in a way who says, you know, here we are. What about this moment? How do we, no matter what you've lost, no matter how difficult it is to think about the past or imagine an ongoing future without what you've lost, here you are right now. And it's in that right now that joy resides. You know, that's the place, I think, where we find our sustenance.
What can you say about the role of place in your poetry?
Wow, my poems tend to be pretty located. And I think it has to do with... Well, a couple of things. One is, you know, the inner life goes on. It is the subject of poetry, but the inner life happens in the body, right? And the body is never nowhere. The body is always someplace. And if you're going to use the physical, you're going to report on sense perception, then your body's in a particular environment. I also think about poetry as a way of charting experience. And I started to really relish the idea that in my New York City poems, they all have basically the address where the poem takes place. 14th and 7th, you know. The barbershop is on 18th Street. It's near the post office. So I began to imagine I was making a map of the city, and I was putting these colored pins in where things happen. And if you keep doing that, in a way, you wind up describing the shape of a life, right? You chart where you've been. I don't keep a journal, not the this-happened-to-me kind, but the poems are a kind of cartography.
The last question from Cecilia Hagen. You've written... You've written wonderful pieces remembering the poets Galway Kinnell, Carolyn Kaiser, and others.
Oh, thank you.
In what ways would you best like to be remembered?
Oh, God. Wow. You know, I will tell you two tiny stories about each of those people. Carolyn and I were once going to give a reading together in New Jersey, and she was, you know, it was later in her life, and she was staying at a hotel. The car driver picked me up first. We went to Carolyn's hotel. And she emerged. She had her hair done that day. It looked like a big blonde moon. And she was wearing a black mink coat. And she got into the car and said to the driver, "May I smoke?" And he said, "Of course, ma'am." You know, and she rolled on the window and she spoke. And we're heading down the Jersey Turnpike, or wherever we are, and there is Patterson. And she points at the exit for Patterson. She says, "Dr. Williams, I wanted to take off my clothes and lie down in front of him." Now, who wouldn't want to be remembered for that, right? I mean, what? Great. Incredibly passionate and stylish and presenting herself. And this is, you know, in a failing body, basically. Galway, going to his house in Vermont, and it was late fall, it was pretty cold, and Galway decided that we should play croquet, which he loved. And so there are about six of us, and we're playing croquet, and... somebody will knock over just and go and say, oh, that's against the rules. And then something else happens, and suddenly Galway gets another turn. Well, that's the rules. And we began to realize that Galway was making up the rules as we and doing so with real gusto. You know, he was really enjoying himself. So now, this says something to me about his poetry, because he was somebody who changed my life as a young man, because his poems raised the bar on sort of the spiritual life of poetry, the profound inner life of poetry. And that's what a poem could do, I thought, listening to him. And he could have stayed in a kind of position where his poems had such high aspirations, but he knew that that was going to damage his work and that it becomes not an inclusive enough position. So the last decade of his life, Galway wrote the goofiest, weirdest, and also most thrilling poems. You know, he would just take such risks that you would never expect. There's a great poem about remembering his son's birthday party, and the little boy, who was like 6 or 7, sat on the cake. He was on a chair. And at the end of the poem, Galway gives a checklist, and he says to his son, "Would you like me to," and there are boxes, "burn this poem, to publish this poem? Give the only copy to you? You know, these choices for the kid to check. This is like, what a weird thing to do. Daring poems. And so that's really exciting.
So, and how would you like to be remembered?
Oh,
that was the other.
I worked so hard to not do
that.
Let
you off the hook totally on that. As excellent as those anecdotes were.
Oh man, how do I want to be remembered? I would like to be remembered as a teacher, because I have loved and mostly still do love the kinds of exchanges that happen with poets around their work, which are so, you know, we have the vehicle of the poem, but we're also really talking about, you know, ourselves. We're talking about how do you grow? How do you get through this part of your life? How do you move forward? And it's going to be very profound and very gratifying. I don't know. I'd like to be remembered as having some wit and style about myself, you know. I would like a little bit of a sort of, you know, Chanel or Jean Cocteau sort of reputation. And in my garden, like, you know, my friend Stanley Kunitz, sort of paying attention to what emerges and what disappears and how we live in relationship to those forces that are so much larger than ourselves. And finally, I'll tell you, here's the way I want to be remembered. Now, about a few years ago, Tracy K. Smith, who was my student, won the Pulitzer. It's my first student to win a Pulitzer Prize. And I said to a poet friend of mine, my first student won the Pulitzer. She said, how many do you think they're going to be? Well, Mr. Gregory Partlow just won the Pulitzer. Two. So I'm not done.
So, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks a lot.
That was Mark Doty performing in Portland in 2015. You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, and the Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online, and you can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.